Oh, I didn't do that. It's saying you're crazy for thinking I did that.
Yeah, what's wrong with you that that's what you remember? Factoring in a level of self-doubt. If that's happening to you, research it, maybe look it up, because that's, as Sonya mentioned, mental and emotional abuse. We are coming up on the end of our time with you today, unfortunately. Thank you so much for listening. Really appreciate it. I'm Althea. Tammy's here too. Sonya's in the studio. I wanted to mention briefly, language is flexible. It changes all the time. And if you try to, put a chokehold on it, you end up like the French government and you borrow words from, American slang English anyway.
Giving us some things to think about, some gems. Thank you all so much for tuning in, and have a great, fantastic weekend. Take care of yourselves, each other, be well, be kind. Thank you all so much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hi, I'm Dina Wilder, and I support John Griffiths by editing his show, Disability Justice, An Everyday Pursuit in Survival. This show is played the first Friday of every month at 9:30 a.m. John's show is an effort to grow the grassroots of advocacy for disability issues, and KBOO is committed to giving community members a platform to have their voices heard. Please support KBOO Nourish the Grassroots of our Community by going to kboo.fm/give.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots. A weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week.
In the summer of 2020, during a worldwide pandemic, a group of musicians met in an open-air pavilion in a small town along the banks of the Mississippi to plan an album. The musicians would come together over a period of 5 months to record this album. It represented a variety of musical influences and training, jazz, blues, country, classical music, and of course, bluegrass. Hi, I'm Dave Strudoff, member of the band Cooley Creek.
And I'm Stephanie Schubert. And for a special Mother's Day edition of Sprouts, the band Cooley Creek teams up with WORT in Madison, Wisconsin to talk about their tribute to bluegrass pioneers Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard. The name of the album Cooley Creek created is entitled Matriarch, Song and Verse. Today, we will hear the band talk about their album, and they will share some poetry and music tracks. But first, who were Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard? Here is some audio of them sharing their songwriting process at the San Diego Folk Festival in 1974, beginning with Hazel Dickens.
I think a song or anything like that has much more depth if you have been through something yourself, or if you have seen something with your own two eyes, as opposed to reading something out of a book and saying, well, this is how you write a song. I've written a lot of mining songs. This one I wrote after there was a big gathering in Horse Creek, Kentucky, where people, about 800 disabled miners and poor people, were challenging the Social Security Administration because they hadn't received any money. And I was one of the people that sang for that. So after I got back home, I was really just thinking about all those people, and I kept seeing their faces, and I just couldn't forget them, so I wrote this song. He's a poor man, 'cause mining's all he's known. And miners don't get rich loading coal. He's a sick man, 'cause that coal dust took its stand. But he don't expect to get no help from that operator man. Well, it's goodbye, old timer. I guess your time has come. Those water holes, that dirty coal dust eating up your lungs. You'll leave this world just as poor as the day you saw the sun. Well, it's goodbye, old timer, all your mining is done.
Here is Alice Gerard.
I don't think that basically I'm a craftswoman. I think that I write as a mood, and I'm not particularly disciplined about it. It's a spare time thing between the kids coming home from school and supper and stuff like this. And the song basically came out of a feeling. Last summer, we had all 7 children with us all summer long, and I was about to go crazy, I swear. It was just an incredible situation there. I didn't have any time to myself, it seemed like. We weren't satisfying ourselves or the kids or anybody else. And I just sort of got sick and gave up. Except that one morning I got up about 5 in the morning. I couldn't sleep. And I came down to the kitchen, and it was so quiet. It was just incredible. And I sat there for about an hour and a half, and I started writing this song. In the early morning light, I creep on down the stairs. Hush, you floor, keep your squeaking down. And the smelling of the coffee and the silence all around. And nothing but my thoughts and the stirring of a song to break the sad, sweet feeling, Lord, of being all alone. And if I'm very still, I can drain this holy hour. And if I'm lucky, stretch it out to 2. Before the world comes crashing, and down the stairs comes truth, and smiles and tears and ratty hair, and I can't find my shoes, and I don't know, no, I don't know if I can make it through. But I hope you know I love you, 'cause I guess it ain't showing much these days. Just old dreams of yesterday keep on getting in the way.
That was Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard speaking at the San Diego Folk Festival in 1974. Here to give more background on these Bluegrass Hall of Fame artists are country music historian Bill Malone and his wife, historian Bobby Malone, from the popular show Back to the Country on WORT.
Okay, I'm Bill Malone, and I created the Back to the Country show about 26 years ago, something like that. And I'm a country music historian. My last full-time teaching job was at Tulane University in New Orleans, but I wrote the basic history of country music called Country Music USA.
Hi, my name is Bobby Malone, and I'm Bill Malone's wife, partner, manager, and sidekick.
And a professional historian.
And a professional historian. Right. I'm also a Southern historian, but I've written on lots and lots of things.
Well, Hazel Dickens is the person that we got to know best. I first became acquainted with her music when we saw the wonderful documentary, which was about a strike labor management conflict in the hills, coal country of Harlan County, Kentucky. She did much of the soundtrack. Her style of singing was just so stark and haunting that it easily captured the attention of the listeners. Then I began to find out, of course, that she was also a bluegrass musician and had grown up in a traditional community in West Virginia. But like much of her family, she had moved to Baltimore, Maryland when she was a young woman, not too long out of high school. And she worked at whatever occupation she could find there, but she met Mike Seeger, the famous singer and folklorist, half-brother of Pete Seeger, who was also living in Baltimore. They brought out the best in each other. Of course, Mike learned from Hazel. He learned a lot of old songs, and he learned a lot about the culture from which the songs came. And Hazel, of course, found legitimacy. She wasn't really respected for her music until she met Mike Seeger. She always said that he legitimized what she did. And so together they grew up in bluegrass music. And that was also her introduction to bluegrass. She'd grown up with old-time ballads and folk songs and religious material, but she didn't really get acquainted in a big way with bluegrass until she moved to Baltimore and became part of the small group of musicians of which Mike Seeger was a part.
And her brother.
Her brother, at least one of them, maybe more, were also bluegrass musicians. And so later on, I guess through some of Mike's friends, she met Alice Gerard. Alice at that time was married to a fellow named Jeremy Foster. And Alice was totally different from Hazel. Alice grew up in an academic family, fairly affluent in California. And like a lot of people, she got caught up in the folk music revival of the late 50s and early 60s, and then from there into bluegrass music. So, of course, Hazel is this purebred, uneducated mountain girl, and Alice Gerard is this affluent daughter of I believe, a professor. But they started singing together, and they found that their voices complemented each other extremely well. And they were different from other women who were interested in bluegrass. Most other women, you know, sang in a sort of a low-pitched sort of harmony that sort of reflected pop music on it. But Alice and Hazel sang in the bluegrass style. They put their songs in the keys that were much higher than what most women had used. They did traditional songs, many of them drawn from Bill Monroe or the Stanley Brothers or the Callahan Brothers. And so their act constituted the first really traditional woman act in bluegrass music.
And was Hazel already writing songs for both of them?
I think Hazel had been writing songs since she was a very young woman. And of course, being a part of a bluegrass act, that gave her an incentive to sing more or to write more. And Alice Gerard also got into the business of writing songs. I guess throughout the rest of her career, she wrote songs too. Although Hazel became famous for her songs, she wrote in the traditional fashion, in the very realistic songs about human breakups and about death and tragedy and labor relationships and that sort of thing. But a writer named Art Menius used this term once, which I think is a very good one. He spoke about what he called the feminization of bluegrass music. And I think that's what Alice and Hazel did. They were the vanguard of the feminization of bluegrass. And since that time, of course, more and more women like Alison Krauss and Rhonda Vincent and Laurie Lewis and on have got into the business of performing in bluegrass. But Alice and Hazel should be considered the
mothers of women in bluegrass music, absolutely.
I think they revealed to other young women that it was possible to have a career in bluegrass. Earlier, women had usually sort of paled under the influence of, you know, dominant men like Bill Monroe or Jimmy Martin. But Alice and Hazel sang the music well, and they sang it in a traditional fashion. They used the high, hard harmonies that men had used. There was nothing namby-pamby or milquetoast about them. And I think they opened the door for people like Alison Krauss and Rhonda Vincent and Laurie Lewis and on and on.
Well, when I first met Bill and started going to bluegrass festivals, I never saw a woman perform with bluegrass music. To me, it was the most male-dominated form of music. You know, it was all white and all male at the time. And so I think that the fact that they were out front, not just the bass player who might come in and do a number singing harmony or something like that, that they were the act.
That they were out there in direct competition with men and doing it extremely well.
So I just think, especially in the kind of milieu that bluegrass was, it being so kind of hidebound to certain kind of a standard of like who were built in Bill Monroe's band and how did they look, and these women were not that at all, and they were
out front.
They were out front, and they worked to be accepted, and they were. So I think that they were mothers of women in bluegrass, and they were real feminist pioneers.
You are listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I am Stephanie Schubert, and today we are spending time with Coulee Creek, a band that recently made a tribute album to bluegrass pioneers Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard, entitled Matriarch, Song and Verse. We just heard some background on these giants of bluegrass from historians Bill and Bobby Malone, and next we will hear from Coulee Creek about their inspiration for this album. And we will end with one of their tribute songs, The Rebel Girl.
Hi, this is David Strudoff.
And Rita Mae Reese.
And I'm Sarah Jackson.
We are members of the group
Coulee Creek. Our new album, The Matriarch Song and Verse, honors the music of bluegrass pioneers and Hall of Famers Alice Gerard and Hazel Dickens.
The last free thing. You get a job in a can factory, in a restaurant, in retail, work all day and sing all night, turning air into sweet sound and hope, with the woman who twines her voice with yours, with the men who back you up, and with all of those strangers who listen. And so you can't settle down, can't settle for less. You cancel your credit cards and give up on owning a house. You learn to believe more in a picket line than a picket fence. You become the patron saint of honky-tonk angels who came from make-do and get-by, who worked for county dispatch, sold Avon, sold junk on the side of the road, sold things they shouldn't and sometimes stuff they didn't even own. But hasn't everyone? You watch your sisters get trapped, work as domestics in the boss's house and then in their own, their marriages a union without any union to back them up. Watch your brothers struggle to get air, the last free thing in this world. And when they can't, leave behind a body and no money to bury it. Every day, more men and women deep in debt and out of breath. You swear one day you'll live to see it. The air free again, and every single one of us, every bit is free. And that was The Last Free Thing by Rita Mae Reese. So The Last Free Thing was inspired in large part by Hazel Dickens sitting with her brother as he died from black lung. At the time, the coal companies were still claiming they weren't responsible, and the miners were dying without even leaving behind enough money to bury themselves. And thinking also about her sister, who she talked about in one of the being in a bad marriage, and her husband basically saying that he was just keeping her around to keep his house for him, and just the levels of being trapped that she saw the people she loved and cared most about, and watching them just struggle for freedom and air and not believing they were going to find that, I think was very moving to me.
Rita, what does Hazel Dickens mean to you?
Well, I knew when I first heard about the Matriarch Project that it was something I wanted to be involved with because I grew up in West Virginia and I'd heard of Hazel Dickens. I'd heard some of her music, but I hadn't really learned very much about her. But I agreed to write a series of poems and dove into the research, which primarily was just listening to her music on repeat. And it was wonderful. My whole family enjoyed that so much. She wrote this music about a mine strike, very contentious, violent mine strike in Harlan County, Kentucky. And her music is so piercing and totally relevant today. She captures the spirit and anguish of living in that region and working those jobs.
Rita, what influence do you think Alice Gerard had on her?
I'm really fascinated by their relationship. I think it gave her courage because she was always, I think, very confident as a musician, but it was really hard for them both, I think, to be women in the music industry at that time. And they were playing bars and they knew they were getting paid less than the male musicians they were with. And so I think if she hadn't had somebody who was from a very different background than she was to help her navigate that and to provide just companionship and courage, having that friendship, I think, enabled her to dream more for herself and her music than perhaps she might have done.
So, hello, my name is Sarah. I am the primary singer on the album The Matriarch Song and Verse.
What was a part of this, looking back at this, what was the part of it that you really enjoyed in this project?
When I first listened to Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard, I thought how vocally or emotionally raw the music was. And I told our project manager, Dave, I have no clue how I'm going to convey this story. I'm also embarrassed to share that I never really encountered bluegrass music personally. I'm a vocalist who studied opera and jazz. So I was fortunate to connect with Alice by phone during the beginning phases of this recording. And we discussed how bluegrass came along. So Alice actually sent me a few unaccompanied spirituals and singings of The Day Is Past and Gone and Long Black Train, along with a few other songs. And so she took the time with me to go through the history that a lot of bluegrass is from a place of longing, and that it's rooted in African American spirituals. And so as a past music major myself, I dug my toes into listening and learning, really trying to find my own place and my own sound while integrating the history that I learned. Alice also gave me vocal pointers regarding the spectrum between bluegrass, country, and folk. And we also discussed musical freedom and interpretation as well. I thought it was really beautiful when we were talking about other covers. She actually sent me a few covers of her songs, one being Pretty Bird with Harmony, and how she appreciated different interpretations of music that she had created. It's amazing to look back at the history and see the path that has been paved by Alice and Hazel.
Joe Hill, the great songwriter and labor organizer, co-wrote the original music and lyrics for Rebel Girl with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, a formidable women's labor rights organizer. She was aware of the intersectionalities of oppression, how being a woman and a worker meant that you could be left out of progress that ostensibly benefited you. She noted that at the time, husbands and fathers would often collect the wages of women, sometimes at the factory door, and the women would never see a cent of it. Joe Hill knew that acknowledging and including women in labor rights wasn't just important for women, it was crucial for the survival of the labor movement, which still gets painted as very male and also very white. He wrote, "The female workers are sadly neglected in the United States, and consequently, we have created a kind of one-legged freakish animal of a union." When Joe was facing execution for murders he very likely didn't commit, he wrote Flynn saying that he was giving her all the credit for the song in the hope she'd go out and find more rebel girls because they were needed and, in his words, needed badly. When the Smithsonian put together a tribute album for Joe Hill on the Folkways label, the producer Lori Taylor knew Hazel Dickens was the obvious choice for Rebel Girl. Hazel updated the lyrics for modern working women, but a manager of a more successful commercial trio pushed the producer to use them for that song instead. The producer, luckily for all of us, refused. I love what Hazel did with the lyrics. She changed the queer world to the more apt, cruel world. She changed "She's a precious pearl" to "She's the strength of this world." And she brings courage, pride, and joy to the fighting rebel boy to "From Maine to Georgia, you'll see her fighting for you and for me." And maybe my favorite revision, she changed "The grafters in terror are trembling" to "And the bosses know that they can't change her." It makes me think back on the women in my family and the women I've worked with who, over the years, stayed true to their class and their kind, who kept their families fed as best they could, but didn't brook any nonsense, and knew, if not exactly how, at least that the system was rigged against them. I love the story of Rebel Girl and the Rebel Girls that passed it along to each other through the years. Hazel knew that the women, whether they were working in the mines or not, were crucial to the success of any strike, as you can clearly see if you watch Harlan County, USA, which Hazel wrote the music for. Rebel Girl has woven a lot of lives, a lot of strength, a lot of history, and an immeasurable amount of resilience together over the years. That's why we knew it had to be included on this album, that is a tribute not only to Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard, but to all of the women who served as matriarchs, whose hands were busy passing along what was good and what was needed. From all of us at Cooley Creek, happy Mother's Day to all of the matriarchs and rebel girls.
Blue-blooded queen or princess who have tried.
That's it for Sprouts. You have been listening to a celebration of bluegrass pioneers Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard by the band Coulee Creek with their album Matriarch, Song and Verse. Our contributors this week from WORT in Madison, Wisconsin, were Shally Pittman and Bill and Bobby Malone from the popular program Back to the Country. Special thanks to the members of the band Coulee Creek, David Strudoff, Sarah Jackson, and Rita Mae Reese. More information on them can be found at CooleyCreek.com. That's C-O-U-L-E-E, CooleyCreek.com. Production assistance by me, Stephanie Schubert. Music you heard included The Rebel Girl, originally written by Joe Hill, and Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, revised by Hazel Dickens, and covered here today by Coulee Creek. Interview and musical audio of Hazel Dickens and Alice Gerard at the San Diego Folk Festival in 1974, provided by Sean Dulles at the Pacifica Radio Archives. Original poetry by Rita Mae Reese. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio, thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Stephanie Schubert. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You're listening to Community Radio,
KBOO, Portland.
Good morning, this is Disability Justice, an everyday pursuit and survival. Your host, John Griffiths.
And Dina Wilder,
board operator.
Before John begins his interview today, I'd like to remind you that KBOO has started their membership drive, and you can support programs like ours, Disability Justice, by going to kboo.fm/give so that you can become a monthly sustaining member.
So in the studio today with me is Nico and Alan. Welcome back.
So this is Alan Hines. He's the director of the Real Choice Initiative, and I'm gonna do communication support for Alan. I use he, him pronouns. And I'm happy to be here. My name is Nico Sara. I use they pronouns. I am a mostly white passing person of color with disabilities. I'm queer and transgender, and I'm a disability justice organizer, and I'm really excited to do this interview with you, a good friend of ours, John. Thank you so much for asking us to be here with you today.
First question, what is the name of the study?
So the study is called the Disability Equity and Engagement Study. And we are gathering some information about the disability community. And we're really focused on learning about the social determinants of health. And how that impacts people's engagement with the city.
Who is sponsoring it and why?
Sure, yeah. So I think the city of Portland, really this was several years ago, they started realizing that there were not a lot of people with disabilities and people with more serious health conditions, that we were as a population not as engaged with the city, and so they started wondering why that was, and that was part of what kind of preceded this whole initiative. And so the city of Portland is actually, they're the people who are funding this study. And we as Real Choice Initiative were selected to be the community organization that's going to lead the study. And we are also asked to collaborate with the Portland State School of Government professor up there, who is going to be our number cruncher and do all of the sort of scientific research number crunching of when we actually get the numbers and make all of those things work.
What is the focus of this study?
The focus of this study is to really get some stuff considering to me a lot important in terms of
So the focus of the study, Ellen said, is for the city of Portland to get an idea of where our community is at in terms of the social determinants of health. We're going to use that information to better understand how the city can engage with us as a community to better meet our needs as they go forward and make policies about how to interact with us and how to make policies that are going to better support our lives. Mm-hmm. They want to know where we're at and how we're doing so that we can work together. But they're trying to find out what's going on for us and you know why we aren't more engaged and how we can become more engaged, what we think should happen in these policies and what we need.
And did you say health at the beginning? I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear that.
Yeah, the social determinants of health.
And social determinants of health.
Yeah.
I mean, exactly what is that?
How a person is able to take themselves.
So Alan said it's housing, it's food, it's health, it's all these different, it's a bunch of different factors that really determines how well a person is able to live their life and the quality of their life. So it's really something that a lot of people learn about when they go to school to become a medical provider or a social worker. There are other people that learn about these things, like Dr. Nisha Shiba probably learned about them when she was going to school to learn about this stuff. The Portland State School of Government professor. It's a very science-oriented sort of thing that takes this data and says, look, there's no sidewalks and there's no grocery stores and there's no fire departments in this neighborhood. And it's no wonder that the people who live there have difficult lives. So it kind of takes all those things and said, we need to have parks, we need to have fire departments, we need to have sidewalks, we need to have grocery stores here, we need to have, all these different things in order to people have, there needs to be a library, all this stuff needs to be there in order for people to have good, fulfilled lives.
So in other words, this wouldn't be like universal healthcare or universal housing or universal income or anything else like that. It would just be some basic environmental proofs within the cities, more accessibility around getting around from one place to another place?
So
all of that is part of it. So like universal basic income and universal healthcare and universal housing for people, those types of programs would very likely improve the social determinants of health and how people engage and the quality of life people have. And so Alan and I were the people who wrote the questions for this survey. So we really took a lot of effort to make sure that the questions are concise so that people can come in and do the questions and move on with their day. And if you are one of the first 100 people to do this survey, you can get a $20 gift certificate. This survey is only for people who are living in the city of Portland. We will also have people available to do the survey with folks over the phone. If you can't do it over the internet, maybe you can't use the internet for whatever reason, you don't have access, you can't see it, or whatever reason you need that support, we're going to have people available to talk over the phone with you and fill out the survey for you. So we're really trying to make sure that it's accessible. We've also got translation support available because we want to reach out to people with health concerns and disabilities in the Russian community, in the Chinese community, in the African communities. We want to hear from people in all of our communities in Portland.
When are you guys putting it on?
So the study goes live on May 17th, and that's going to be 6 weeks. The link will be live. And people can access it through our website, which is realchoiceoregon.com. We're gonna also be doing a big social media launch a week and a half before the survey opens. And then we're gonna be keeping that social media campaign going the entire time the survey is open. And then afterwards, we're really excited about doing our town hall, which is we're gonna take a couple of weeks after we finish getting all of that survey information from everybody in the city. And we're going to put those initial numbers together with Dr. Nisha Shiba. And then we're going to take that information back to the community members who took the survey. And we're going to say, here's what we got. What do you think? Did we miss anything? And that's going to be a huge virtual event. It's going to be all online because we want to keep everyone safe with the pandemic. We're going to welcome everybody that took the survey to come meet online and give their feedback about if we missed anything, is there anything else that you feel really needs to be emphasized? And we're gonna bring all that information to the city council after we finished all of these things.
Mm-hmm. So we have a little clip for y'all to listen to.
All right, and this is with Layla Hale and Lids, who are also helping to put together this survey and are gonna be some of the survey takers and our social media influencers and just all around amazing individuals. So here's the clip. Thanks, John.
My name is Layla Hale. I use they, them pronouns, and I work for the Office of Equity and Human Rights as their ADA Title II coordinator. And I am really excited about this project because I know that data is, you know, the first step in getting done what we need to get done. If the data doesn't exist, then the problem doesn't exist. So I'm really excited to be, to assist in being a megaphone to those with power, to amplify the needs that we know have been in our community for a very long time.
Hi, my name is Liz, and I also use they, them pronouns. Yeah, I'm really excited to be a part of this project. I'm an artist and organizer, and my entire goal is to basically help organize all of the stuff that's already happening and make sure that, you know, Indigenous folks and queer folks and disabled folks and anyone who experiences marginalized identities has voices and doesn't have to rely on people talking for us. So yeah, that's kind of what I do, and I'm helping with communication and getting the survey out to folks.
Part of why people have been sent off to places and why people are sent to nursing homes and to other facilities is because the ADA never covered housing, right? So the ADA, they cover when you go into the common area, right? So they have to cover the bathroom and the lobby, but they don't cover your apartment, right? So your apartment doesn't have to be accessible. And that's something that's got to change. And that's something that I hope that, you know, maybe will come out of this study. The city will understand and start learning about, wow, there are a lot of people with disabilities living in our city that are living in places that are inaccessible and they need something better and different. And so I'm hoping people will really engage with this study and say, look, here's what I'm dealing with, and I need something else. That's just something that this city of Portland has never asked before, really. And they're finally realizing they need to ask us what's going on in order to start fixing these problems.
Zooming in a little further, the picture is not we need to fix the ADA. The problem is, like, we need to stop trying to be in compliance with a rule that's almost 30 years old, over 30 years old. That wasn't good enough to begin with. Like, the Civil Rights Act didn't pick up folks with disabilities, and the ADA didn't pick up housing, and we keep leaving out all these things when the answers are just there. They've been there, right? So I feel like this is less of a, we need to figure out how many people like who use wheelchairs aren't voting for like water cleanliness in this bureau, right? Like that's not what we're looking for. What we're looking for is folks to say, hey, what is the strategy? What is the direct most effective strategy to take care of everyone? Like, because as a disability community, we naturally represent so much, right? Because there's, you can't, it's inescapable. It's a part of life. Like, I'll stop talking now.
And Alan said, what I feel like what we're used to as a community is being separated into these different buckets. Different dollars and different buckets for different types of disabilities. Like blind folks might get certain number of dollars from Social Security. Which might be different than someone who's got cerebral palsy or a veteran or an elder. And with all these service systems being different and designed specifically per disability. It makes it really hard for us to develop a strategy. And make sure that nobody's getting left out. What I was thinking about when you were talking, Layla, is I think in general, like what Alan was saying, you know, we've got everybody split up, and it's just like, okay, if you got mental health stuff, if you're a veteran, if you're an elder, if you're a child, if you've got IDD, you know, acquired, all these, you know, all these different buckets, yeah. And also, like in general, for strategy speaking, for getting involved with doing mutual aid or doing work around civic engagement or changing the government or whatever it is where people decide they want to throw their energy, what are the bigger strategies? Is the strategy to show up and say, I said something, I did something, I was there, I marched, I held a sign? Or is there a bigger strategy to it? Is there a strategy to say, I'm doing X, Y, and Z, which will at the end of the strategy be that there is housing for 100 people, or that there is this law that mandates that X, Y, and Z takes place, you know, whatever it is, the strategy, right? But I mean, that's a whole complicated thing, right? That to figure out how to do this stuff. And I remember one of the last things I heard Nick Fish say in a meeting when I went to City Hall before he passed, was he said something like, it was like 48% or 52% of Oregonians don't know that there's two senators per state for federal senators. And just knowing that people don't know that there's two senators per state, like, and then getting into like how complex all of these laws and just the city level, like passing a law is so complex, and lobbying and showing up and sending an email and making a phone call. I mean, even just to like sign up to testify, to be like, hey, y'all are talking about changing the funding system for the police. Like, I would like to see more money going into housing. I would like to see more money going into healthcare, for example. I don't like how it's being sent over to cops right now, or you know, whatever you have decided you want to work on, right? That's something that a whole lot of people in Portland decided to call in and testify about this last year. Just signing up to testify, that's like a whole process on its own, you know? So it takes a lot of work just to be involved in one way or another. And people are like, especially people with disabilities, we're like, yo, I'm just trying to like clean my clothes, get some food, like take my meds, try and call to get whatever it is like that's shut off right now, turn back on so I can get through tomorrow, whatever it is. What do you think, Liz? Where are you at?
Well said. Oh my God. Well, I'm just thinking about, let me see if I can say this without cussing. No, I'm thinking about how, like, honestly, the biggest lesson, like, I've organized in a lot of different capacities, and I kind of went from, like, grassroots organizing with my neighbors to organizing, like, a voting campaign back to, like, heck with all this, I'm going to go just organize with my neighbors, because when it comes down to it, we know as disabled people, working class people, like, people of color, queer people, we know that our energy is really, really valuable. Like, it's really hard to decide how to delegate, like, how much time we're going to be spending on different things. And we need to know what the impact is going to be. And a lot of people that I organize with aren't voting anymore, because why would they spend all this time educating themselves on, like, a gamble of a politician or measure that they haven't read or can't, you know, access because it's not accessible language, when they could put that much amount of time into, like, mutual aid and community aid. And, like, people on, like, the reservation, like my grandma grew up on, are, like, dealing with COVID, like, so much right now. Why would I give a heck about who's running for some, you know? It's really hard to prioritize that. And, like, what's really exciting to me about this study is we can put numbers behind that sentiment. Like, we can say, like, this is why this is important to us. Like, our immediate need for food and shelter, clean water, like, safety, like, that is more important than who might make a rule in 3 years where we get $600 one time. It's just not tangible. So I'm excited to have numbers behind that sentiment personally. Not sure if that's exactly what we're talking about here, but that's where I'm going with it. So thanks for letting me go off a little bit.
Thank you. That's exactly what we're talking about. Thank you for saying, you know.
Yeah, I feel like this is definitely for me, like, part of a larger strategy. Like, it can't for me end with numbers. Like, that would be, like, the most self-defeating thing ever if we just ended with, you know, a nice, like, Survey Monkey printout of, like, these percentages and pie charts and, like, okay, cool. Like, I feel like the town hall that happens after, we, like, both share back the information and have the opportunity to connect and strategize as a community. I see it as very much as, like, a jumping off point for something like the People's Plan that PALF, which is now Imagine Black, put together. That was where they surveyed the, like, a wide sampling of, like, the Black community in Portland and beyond, and like, presented, like, a People's Plan based on that information. So I see this not only as, like, this is the civic engagement. It's not just a survey to see, like, why aren't you gonna vote? Like, it's, hi, hello, we're gathering information, and also, let's do the thing, right? Like, I feel like Lindsay said earlier, like, hi, I'm here, where's the fire? Like, and I see, like, that's definitely, like, my role as a civil servant. And, like, you know, I still very much see myself as, like, an activist and organizer. Like, I want this to be a conduit for, like, tell me what to tell my bosses to do. How do I be the most radical change that I can be? And this is the blueprint, right? This is the data-driven measure where I say, okay, here's our scientific and historical data that says this is what we should be doing right now. You can't tell me I can't have this program because the people said that this is what they need.
Yeah,
Ellen said, yeah, I think that that was an important factor in the development of this project.
We wanted to make sure there was not only a community,
we wanted to make sure that it was not only inclusive of all of our different communities, but also that it was truly accountable to all of our different communities. Because we as a disability community are used to having these very focus group models. which would be great if you could get a truly representative group together. What I see, though, is more homogenous. What I see usually is more white people with disabilities. And parents who talk for people with disabilities. And we really want to hear from people with disabilities themselves. And do whatever we can to accommodate them. To accommodate us. To be able to provide the information that will best support our communities. So we designed the study from the beginning to have a town hall. We worked closely with the Coalition of Communities of Color. And they were the ones that really taught us about this idea of bringing the data back to the community. So that we can interpret it as a community. And to really make sure that we've caught all of the nuances in the data. So I'm really looking forward to that town hall event. And hearing from participants of the survey.
For more information about the Disability Equity and Engagement Study, go to the website of Real Choice Initiative. You can find it at realchoiceoregon.com. Next month, we will have part two of this discussion with Alan and Nico about the disability study here in Portland.
Dear KBOO listeners, I would first like to say thank you to KBOO for giving a voice to those of us who do not have a voice. And so far as I know, the only one who has done this for our community. Please support them as they support us.
You can donate by going to kboo.fm/give. You can also click donate in mobile app or text KBOO to 44-321.
That's the end of Disability Justice. Since we cannot be fully aware of everybody's difficulties within the community, we would really like it if you would send us your email, disabilityjustice@kboo.org.
Also, we're always looking for fun, inexpensive things to do out in the community. Go to disabilityjustice@kboo.org to contact us and give us your ideas.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU